Good afternoon, and welcome to Tate Modern. I am Gabriela Salgado, Curator of Public Programs. Today's event is one of a series that we are organizing jointly with Art Monthly, and it's a series of conversations called Talking Art. As you know, Art Monthly is a very popular magazine, edited by Patricia Vickers, who is right next to me. And the series that we're running are very exciting conversations with between artists and cultural thinkers, critics, and people who have been associated with Art Monthly. So this is one of a series of talks that happened this year. And the last part of the season will be with Christian Markley next month in November. This is announced in that piece of information that you have in your seat. You also have another piece of information in your seat that is about the subscription. You get a discount and subscription to the magazine if you hand it out today to the two people from Art Monthly that are here, and one is Brendan at the back of the room and the other one is Frederica at the front. So you have the opportunity to get a discount in the subscription if you want to do so. We have also a stellar lineup of speakers next spring, including Gustav Metzger, Cornelia Parker, and Glenn Ligon. So keep an eye on the website to get informed about this series. And today, I have great pleasure in introducing the speakers that will have a conversation today. One is artist Jip van Lieswood from Atelier van Lieswood, which is a team of creatives based in Rotterdam. Atelier van Lieswood is particularly renowned for its socially engaged practice, and that practice extends to the fabrication of artworks that promote self-sufficient and independent lifestyle. In conversation with Jörg van Lieswood is critic and art historian Markus Verhagen, who has been at Tate many times before. I think, is my voice going? You can hear me? And is a regular contributor to Art Monthly as well. So just a couple of announcements. Wait for the microphones, please, when you want to ask a question, because we are filming this event and it will be webcast. And the other thing is, please switch off your mobile phones. So enjoy the event, and thank you for coming.
Thank you. Okay. Now, I'm imagining that most people here are familiar with the work of Atelier van Lieshout, either with the earlier work, the living units, often made out of shipping containers, and including various facilities, toilets, kitchens, beds, and so on, or perhaps with the later work, with the more recent work, much of which consists of models through which Atelier van Lieshout has imagined the functioning of large communities, essentially totalitarian communities run along fairly insane lines. My interest in the work of Atelier van Lieshout started I started looking more carefully at the work of Atelier van Lieshout a few years ago when I was doing a bit of research on utopianism in contemporary art. This was around the time of A.V. Elville, which I imagine some of you will have heard of, when Joop and his collaborators declared their studio in Rotterdam a free state. And I thought this was a utopian project. I'm less certain now, but we can talk about that in a minute. Now, I thought perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about why you went from working under your own name mm-hmm. to founding Atelier van Lieshout in 1995.
Yes, I can. Actually, I was educated as a sculptor in Rotterdam and started working as an artist after that. And around 94, I changed the name in Atelier van Lieshout, and it had two reasons. One of the reasons was a conceptual one, because at that time I was very much questioning the position of art by making furniture, by making artworks in limited editions, and to reduce my role as an artist or designer as a contractor. So basically I said to people, if you want to have an artwork like a toilet or a bathroom or a kitchen, just tell me how you want it and I will make it for you. So to change the name in the artist in the name of the company was a conceptual one. The other one was a more pragmatical one, at that time I did a commission in France. I collaborated with Rem Koolhaas, the architect, and the French clients, they didn't like Rem Koolhaas and they didn't like me, so they say, no, we don't work with artists, we only work with real companies. So that's why I said, okay, I make my own company. So that was the reason, the pragmatical reason to use. And then I like to use this name. Nowadays, I mean, for me now at this time, the conceptual reason disappeared because I'm not questioning that thing anymore.
Okay. So initially it was a company. Is it? Does it remain? Does it have elements of a commune, or is it an Atelier van Lieshout? I want to talk in a minute about A.V. Elville, of course, but given how interested you are, obviously, in organizational structures and how communities are managed, I was wondering how you manage Atelier van Lieshout.
Well, during the time of A.V. Elville, the Free State, you could say there were two parts. One of it was the atelier, Atelier van Lieshout, which was my studio, which was structured as a company, with me being the boss, and with rules that everyone had to start work at 9 o'clock and so on. So there was basically very much organized like any other company. And the Free State itself, let's say, there was this piece of land in front of my studio where I said to, they declared the Free State, and I told to my people, you can do whatever you want there. If you want to build your house, you can build a house. There's no rules, no aesthetic rules, no technical rules. You can have parties. You can have intercourse with animals if that's one of your desires. So there was no morale, no rule whatsoever. And that was a very anarchistic, you could say, a part, a non-structured part.
Okay. So it has both.
And that position in Avielville, I didn't have any, well, of course I had power, but I mean, I didn't want to be the boss of that place. Yeah.
Since we're there already, let's talk about Avielville. It's sort of the culmination point, isn't it, of a certain line of development in your work. Mm-hmm. You know, in pieces made over the 5-year period before Avielville, mm-hmm. You consistently show an interest in self-sufficiency. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, you created something a little like a free state with a currency and a constitution, I think. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a bit about how it came about and how it worked during those 9 months?
Basically, from the beginning onwards, I always have been very much interested in functional artworks and basically creating worlds, you could say, like by making a certain group of objects or mobile homes, you create a world. And then at a certain moment, I just said, okay, I have all the stuff needed almost to start a Free State, so let's do it. And how it worked, it started a very... So pretty unorganized. And this is also a time in Holland that 2000 was a very, Holland has this tradition allowing things, you know, that the law should not be implied so strictly as long as you don't cause big problems. It's like this kind of very soft law. And basically... it means that you could do many things, you had a lot of liberty, unless you really make a big mess. And so that was also the idea that I started. So, I'm going to make a nice place, art and friendly people and little parties, and everyone will like it. But at exactly the same time as well, there was a political change, and a lot of people, they became against this law that allowed soft drugs and prostitution and all these kind of things. And at that very moment, we were published in all the newspapers and televisions, and so we were like the ones sticking out the head, and they came all to me as being the example, you could say.
Oh, really? You think you were scapegoated?
Well, absolutely. I mean, they were not very collaborative, no.
So what exactly happened?
Exactly happened is that we got a lot of inspectors. Like we had a bar and restaurant. Of course, we didn't have a building permit. We didn't have a restaurant permit, no alcohol license. And we just wanted to make this place. And I thought it was possible. But then they say, no. You need to have a building permit and a liquor license and this and that. And then we had a farm. And then there was the European farm inspection coming, and they said you have to put. We had two pigs and I don't know, 20 rabbits and chicken, like nothing. It's like almost like a petting zoo. And then they said, no, you have to have concrete here, and then special tanks for the shit, and then you have to do this, and you have to sterilize. You know, it's like a lot of rules. And then we make this. We had this heating system with renewable energy, and they say, no, you should be a filter. So they really, I mean, laws are made to control things.
Yeah.
And
now, this wasn't the first time you had a run-in with local authorities, was it? I think in Rabastens, for your show, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, a couple of years earlier, the mayor shut down your show, if I remember rightly. Yeah. You showed Mercedes with 57mm cannon. Mm-hmm. That's a title. Yeah. It's also obviously a description of the work. And on account of that piece, I think the show was closed down.
Yeah.
And a clip-on, I think that was. Didn't that fall foul of local building regulations?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. What I was wondering is, to what extent are these clashes expected? Do you set yourself up to have these confrontations?
No, not at all. I'm always surprised when it happens, especially this thing in Rabastens, which was like a normal exhibition. There was no dirty pictures or something like that. It was a quite decent show, I would say. I was completely surprised that it happened, and I think it has much more to do with I think there was a show in a village, and the mayor said, okay, a lot of the people don't like the show, so I will be the hero of the town and close it down. And so he did, and there was a lot of publicity, which was very good for the show. And actually, the mayor got fired by the minister, I think. So, and I mean, it's not intended. I mean, because I prefer to, just do my thing and to create artworks and have fun.
So with AVLville, it wasn't. I know you consulted a lawyer, didn't you, beforehand? But you thought perhaps you could muddle through. And were you hoping that AVLville would last over a long period of time?
Well, I always expected that it would first grow to the size of 1,000 people, and then would exist for 1,000 years.
So there was a master plan.
There was a master plan. Huh. And I really didn't expect that I would have so much problems.
Okay. Huh.
But I was also a little bit naive, probably. I still am.
Okay. Perhaps that naivety is enabling in a way. I wanted to ask just a little bit about the specifically Dutch context mm-hmm. of your work. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously, you know, a very strong libertarian impulse behind mm-hmm. a lot of your work, mm-hmm. behind A.V. Elvin, mm-hmm. For a start. There's a sense that, you know, you're pushing against barriers, you're trying to break them down, trying to find new areas of personal freedom. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense, you know, when you tell about these about your surprise mm-hmm. at a project like AVL being shut down, there's a sense that, you know, you're offering a kind of critique of a highly regulated environment, mm-hmm. that you're proposing a less, you know, a less regulated mm-hmm. environment. I was wondering whether there's a commentary there on the Dutch model in which mm-hmm. the state is mm-hmm. Well, there's this tradition of social tolerance, but the state is ever present. It plays mm-hmm. Perhaps a more visible part in daily mm-hmm. life. There's a more finely regulated environment in Holland. I think
there is a hate-love relationship towards that. So on one hand, I like complete freedom to do whatever I want and wherever and whenever. And on the other hand, I think a certain control is necessary. So, I mean, for example, for environment, urban planning. And like, for example, if you go to Holland, it's a country with extreme urban planning. But that means, like, for example, my city where I live, Rotterdam and Amsterdam as well, you take your bicycle and within 5 minutes you are in a kind of landscape as it looked like 600 years ago. And so that makes it also very, very interesting. And but by doing this, I really touched a subject in the Netherlands, which is because there's a lot of people also, let's say, avant-garde people that say, no, there's too many rules. And other people say, no, it's good like this. So it's a absolutely discussion point. And yeah. To me, a hate and love relationship.
So, among other things, AVL-ville was probing at that discussion, was trying to give a new impetus to that discussion.
Yeah, what it is very often is that people make a rule, and the rule doesn't really function, so they make a new rule, and they make a new rule, and a new rule. So you get rule on top of a rule, and a rule, and a rule. And that means that, that too many rules are there, so I think. You should just take away many of those rules and make one simple rule. And so because they keep the old rules, so they don't exchange them.
All right. Well, that makes sense in the context of more recent work in which you seem to have one simple rule. But we can get to that later. It seems some of your work, and I'm thinking here specifically of the Schiphol skull, which is this red box, effectively, mm-hmm. with a big bed where you can rest in the airport or near the airport. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah.
In the airport. That it's in a sense, you know, it plays on this tradition of social tolerance. Mm-hmm. It looks not just like a rest place, but mm-hmm. a place where you could go and have sex. So, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about how that works, and whether you're lampooning a certain or commenting on a certain aspect of.
Yeah, I also make soundproof boxes in museums and many other places. Yeah. I think every public place should have a place to relax and to do what you want. And so I did the same thing for the airport, and but actually it was never used. The thing was, when they gave me the commission, that I asked them, you know, is there any rules? You know, I said no rules, only two things: no sex, no pigs. For the rest, you can do whatever you want. So I make a thing without sex, no pigs, and then I installed it, and then they said, yeah, it should be fireproofed as well. And it was not fireproof, so it was not allowed. People were not allowed to go in. So, but maybe it was just a lie for them that they didn't want people to go inside. And another interesting story was like a couple of years ago, there was always an anti-prostitution law in the Netherlands, and then this was legalized. They say, I mean, if you want to be a prostitute, it's fine with us. You can make your little company, and you can have all the benefits, social benefits. You have to pay tax, of course. So prostitution became a legal job. Then immediately after, one of these big entrepreneurs from Amsterdam wanted to open big nightclub and striptease bar in the Schiphol airport. And that made me very proud. I mean, this is something that if Netherlands would have done this, this would have been, I think, a beautiful place. But of course, they didn't allow that.
Sorry. All right. You're teaching me all sorts of things I didn't know about Holland. All right. I think in a second we'll move on from the subject of Holland. But one last thing. I mean, we touched on this actually over lunch just a minute ago. I personally associate caravans with Holland and with a specifically Dutch way of going off on holiday. And it's interesting to me that a lot of your early works consist of structures on wheels, you know, the Bezodrome, modular house mobile, thank you, the 3M mobile. A lot of these structures are made to move around. Tell me about that. Why wheels? Why put these things on wheels?
Well, I think there's many reasons for it. So one of it is that you can move it. And the other reason is it gives a freedom that you can. It's also like creating like a capsule, you could say, that you can take with you and move around, creating your world. And another reason was legislation. Basically, it means if you build like a house, you need a building permit. You have a lot of rules. You have to comply with this and this and this. If you screw some wheels under it, it's a mobile home, and then there's no rules anymore. I mean.
The inspectors can't.
No, it's basically there is no rules. I mean, you can do as long as you put some wheels under it. It's a vehicle, it's an object. So, and that was a reason, of course, to find a way around the rules to do what I wanted to do. And it doesn't have to do so much with the Dutch national hobby of camping.
Fair enough. Moving on to, I'd like to talk a little bit about a little more about sex in your work, and I want to start by asking about the phallus. And there are, you have a lot of pieces with phallic objects.
Yes.
I'm thinking, I mean, there I could mention any number of different pieces, but I'm thinking. Actually, yesterday I went to see your show at the Carpenter's Workshop, and there are phallic lamps, big phallic lamps, on the Sonsbeek raft you made, which is a sort of a restaurant in the form of a raft. Is that right?
Exactly, yes.
There's a phallus at the front that acts as a kind of signature. And so I was thinking, why the phallic objects?
Yeah. I don't know, Louise Bourgeois, I think she has even more phalluses than me.
Yes.
So I don't feel so guilty anymore. And I don't know why I do it. It's very often it's just like, in my work, I work in a very intuitive way, and basically once every couple of months I really have the urge to make another phallus. And why? I don't think. I think it's a very something very primitive. It has to do with the origin of man, with masculinity, with reproduction, with power, with domination, with enjoyment, with sex. With, I don't know. Yeah. So I never asked myself this question: why or should I do it? because I don't care about that.
Let's talk about masculinity then in a broader sense. Yeah. I mean, the work, your work has, you know, the masculine mm-hmm. written in bold letters all mm-hmm. over it. I'm thinking of, you know, the emphasis on mm-hmm. technological mastery in works like mm-hmm. The Technocrat or the militarism of mm-hmm. your workshop mm-hmm. for weapons and bombs, or the sexual bravado mm-hmm. of modular multi-woman bed. Mm-hmm. Why this display of masculinity?
Again, there is not really a reason for that, and I think it's just it's my style, you could say, or it's the thing I'm intrigued with. The only thing I can say maybe is that I'm very much interested in power, and also power in all different kinds of levels, but also like in the society. And I think power, maybe before was physical strength, maybe now it's intelligence or money, economic power. So I think in that sense it really has to do with that. I mean, with the research I do, this wandering through the power.
So the phallus or this masculine dimension is part of you're looking at power.
Yeah, but it's also sex, of course, and it's something very nice to do.
And so, but about power, what is it? Are you advancing a critique of power? Are you looking at how it works?
I think it's inevitable.
Inevitable,
yeah. And and that is also that I'm very interested. So I never want to, like also A.V.L. Ville, I mean, this was like, in a way, I retreat myself. But on the other hand, I use the tools and the mechanisms that our world uses. And so I'm not against power. I just know that the world functions, people function with around power, the use of power. So it's not really a criticism, but more a registration. And
okay. Still thinking about sex and the body and so on. I was wondering, in a lot of slightly more recent works, mm-hmm. you isolate body parts or organs. Mm-hmm. In bar rectum, for instance, mm-hmm. which I think is shown here, or in bikini bar, mm-hmm. or in the series of mm-hmm. enormous internal mm-hmm. organs.
Yeah.
You focus on specific. Yeah. Body parts. Mm-hmm. Why isolate them?
I think there's a couple of reasons for those organs, and one of them is that it's a system. And then one of the other works I made was The Technocrat. It was a very technical work about recycling of biogas and force feeding, and so there was a very complicated machine in which the human was reduced to a small particle, and the machine as a master. And then, and it was also a digestion system because it was gas, biogas, shit, food, and so on. And your own organs, your own digestion system is also a system, but on a very personal level. So you have like the big system, the group or the society, and the individual. So this juxtaposition interested me a lot. And then there was another reason for it, because it's about the design. Design plays a very big role in my work, so I use design as a palette for creating my artworks. And and the design of organs is very beautiful, but I mean, you really don't know how they work and why they look like they look. I mean, why don't they look like stuff that we would make ourselves? And then you can ask yourself, who was the designer of this? Is this evolution? Is there a higher creature? So it goes really back to a kind of very big life question, these organs. Then another thing, that I used those organs to create functional objects, like the womb house or the bar rectum. And that, again, also has to do with design. So I wanted to turn my back to the contemporary design, and I wanted to create something which was like completely, the form was completely independent of the function, the materials or the design that I used was independent of fashion, or I'd say trends. And so that's I just want to make beautiful forms, and then I cut the door on it and some windows, yeah. And then it's a house.
Then isn't there a risk that, you know, if you create, I know, a huge digestive tract, but you're using it to perform some function, you have a bar in it, for instance, isn't there a risk that people will say, especially... That people will say, well, you're looking at the body as a kind of convenience, I'm thinking in particular of Bikini Bar, which is a woman's body. Isn't there a risk that people will say, look, you're treating a woman's body as a facility or a series of facilities?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I never heard this criticism. But I don't know. I think it's nice that it's the only body that you can enter without asking. So I think that was the freedom.
Okay. All right. Let's move on. You a second ago you mentioned the technocrat,
yeah.
and you spoke very, very briefly about what the technocrat is. It's actually a phenomenally complex work, and as I understand it, it's not just one work. It's generated a series of works that perhaps all relate to the same overarching idea. It seems that around this time. There's a real shift in your practice around the time of Sportopia or the technocrat. Yeah. So at the beginning of the 21st century, and there's a movement from making objects that can be used to thinking about models and systems, much larger social forms, and there's a shift from sort of bottom up. Systems to top-down systems, and from the self-contained community as a kind of refuge to the self-contained community as a totalitarian state. Basically, it seems there's a movement towards more megalomaniacal work and in my view, more pessimistic work. Am I imagining this, or do you agree that there's a shift?
No, that's absolutely a shift. And I think the shift has actually to do with the AVLville, or the end of AVLville, let's say, the breaking of the big dream, you could say. So after that, I make, in a way you could say, the contrary. Like, you know, I started to work on more like system as something that is like, controlling or pushing you down.